Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pop Health Podcast. My name is Gavin Ward, and I'm the host of Pop Health Podcast. And today, I am in Northern California with my co-host, Joe Zimmer. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Gavin.
And we are actually, we're not on vacation, but our guest is. David Sion, the regional administrator from CMS, has welcomed us to his home on this lovely day. David, thanks so much for having us today.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
So we're really excited to be meeting with David and just learning more about him and his role at CMS. And I'm sure the audience, many of you out there, are going to be very interested in what CMS is doing, what they're doing well, perhaps any challenges, and how we as a community can best work together. So before we get started into kind of the business side of things at CMS, David, tell us what you've been doing on vacation. Has it been a week or?
No, I'm just getting started, and I'm going off to a camp up at Echo Lake, which is South Lake Tahoe, to play blues music all weekend, actually, with a bunch of friends.
What instrument do you play?
I play the upright and electric bass, and I play some guitar and sing as well.
Excellent. I'm a big blues fan myself.
So how long is your vacation, just for the weekend, or?
That's going to be the weekend, and then some staycation next week, do a few chores around the house.
So CMS lets you take some time off.
At the end of the summer, yeah.
All right. Very good. Well, again, thanks so much for joining us today, David. Besides the musical instrument, is there anything else folks might be interested about you outside the business side?
Well, since your folks aren't seeing me, one of the things that make people remember me is that I'm tall. I'm 6'8" tall. And somebody asked me the other day if I liked being tall. And you don't get a chance to try it out. But when you have something about you that's quite noticeable, it's a defining characteristic and people remember you. And that's actually a pretty handy thing to have in life.
Excellent. And David, how did you end up at CMS?
Well, when I got out of college, I was thinking about going to law school. I was a philosophy major, and that was during the Carter recession. The economy was terrible, and I wanted to make money. So I continued doing what I did in school, which was play music. That's how I got through college. And I did that for a couple of years, and it was pretty hard work. And through a friend, I got a job working in vocational rehab, initially driving the van, picking up clients and vocational work jobs. And eventually I was running the workshop. And from there, I through taking a test, which is the way you went to work for the government in the old days, I went to work at CMS in 1978.
Wow. And 1978, that's quite a long time. How's your experience been overall?
Well, it's amazing. In a lot of ways, it's been like a family to me. I was in our Philadelphia regional office. I was in our headquarters in Baltimore. I've been out here since the year 2000 in San Francisco. And it's a really amazing organization because they let you try things and do things that would be difficult to do in business. So the constraint that some periods it's difficult to recruit people creates an opportunity for people that are there to try doing something. So I've been a computer programmer and a public affairs specialist. And I've worked with quality improvement organizations. I've done survey and certification. All these different things I had the opportunity to do, probably never would have been able to do in the private sector.
Excellent. It's great to have a fellow East Coaster here. I actually grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania myself, so I too know about moving from the East Coast to the West Coast, and sure do love it here. David, could you tell us a little bit about your role as the regional administrator now and a little bit about your day-to-day in the job?
Sure. So we have 10 regions at Health and Human Services, of which CMS is a part, and the San Francisco region, which of course is the best one, includes Hawaii, California, Arizona, Nevada, and the three Pacific Trust territories, which geographically, it's obviously the broadest of the regions. Tremendous difference between the states. And after you're here for a while, you get to know people in the states, and you really get a sense of the character and a kind of a fondness for Arizona as a place or Nevada as a place. And I really like that about it. And so our field deployment of people, there's about 200 people here, are mostly involved in working with the state Medicaid programs, the state survey and certification programs, overseeing the work of our fraud and abuse and Medicare payment contractors and our Medicare health plans. And then I have a front office staff that focuses on external and intergovernmental affairs and public relations. We just spent a day up in Santa Rosa with Representative Thompson up there, who's on the Health Subcommittee of Ways and Means and some hospitals. So we like to go out and meet with people and try to bring back to our headquarters and the policymakers the challenges that people in the field here face.
Well, one thing I've enjoyed over the last year or so, David, is seeing how approachable you have been. And I think before that time, I was, and I think a lot of the audience is maybe fearful of CMS and, oh my gosh, you big bad CMS. So my next question to you is actually, what do you think CMS is doing really well and why? And before you jump into that answer, I just want to say your approachability and your role has been really appreciated. And I think I had a myth beforehand, and now I'm realizing that wasn't true.
Well, you know, it's a distinct pleasure that we met at one of the readmission prevention collaborative meetings that Josh Luke has put together, and we've got another one coming up in a few weeks here. And those meetings, I find, they're different than a conference. People that are there really believe in what they're doing, you know, making people survive and thrive back at home after they've had a procedure or whatever. And that's exciting. And I think, you know, the work that your organization is doing and so many others, it's got something a little bit more to do with life than just work. And that's what's, I think, really changed about CMS. It's always been a very interesting place because we do so many things. But since the Affordable Care Act and the tremendous investment that the Congress decided to make in research and development, we're doing so many new things and finding out that we can actually really move the needle in a bunch of ways that it's really energized me, and I feel like I've started all over again.
So you said you've been able to do a bunch of new things and move the needle. Would you mind sharing any examples of what you've done that's fairly new and how you've moved the needle?
Well, I think, you know, on a top line, something that's very important to you and what we're talking about today is we've made a real dent in the readmission problem. We've dropped it down a couple of points from maybe 18, 19, 20% to 2 or 3 percentage points lower for several different reasons, and we'll talk about some of those. And we've also, through the Partnership for Patients, reduced things like pneumonia that comes incident to a ventilator. That's cut, I think, 64%. We've cut before-term births. So by really focusing on what we know we can do and sticking with it, we're making care better and safer. And that's something to get excited about.
Can you tell me a little bit more about Partnership for Patients, the term you just used?
Right. So the Partnership for Patients is an investment that the department made with Affordable Care Act money with hospitals and other healthcare providers all over the country, doing things like creating learning collaboratives, funding initiatives to target certain patient safety areas, doing training, providing technical assistance, and perhaps most important, finding those really high-performing institutions and getting their leaders to go out and coach other people so that we can bring the bar up for everyone.
Great. Thanks, David. And what, David, specifically is CMS doing in Arizona and California with the hospital and inpatient community to improve outcomes, care transitions, and prevent hospital readmissions?
Well, as part of the Partnership for Patients, one of the projects that we've engaged in is what's called Hospital Engagement Networks. We funded a new round of these in 2015, $218 million, and there was a first round in 2012, of which California played a big part. And that group had a fair amount of success, I would say, in attacking the readmission problem and attacking a number of these problems. For example, here in California, the Dignity Hospitals was one of the participants in that, and they reduced hypoglycemia events by 65%. And if you're one of those people that are in the hospital and don't have to deal with that problem, you know, you're a happy camper. So, you know, it's not perfect. There's a lot more work to be done, but we've seen a lot of success. And again, there's no reason every institution, every home care agency can't be as good as the best one. We just have to show them how to do it. And I think our playing a kind of a convener role has been really helpful. And what is really exciting is to see people at a more grassroots level take that on. I recently did a meeting in Contra Costa County where they've created their own healthcare transition summit. They had over 300 people there, everything from the ambulance drivers to oxygen people to emergency responders to health plans, really saying, how are we going to reduce this problem here in our county? And I think that's been a really important movement since the Affordable Care Act. We're paying more attention to health at a kind of a population level, because working on the people as individuals, you won't get the same lift as if when you focus on the whole group.
So I know I've had the privilege of working closely with Health Services Advisory Group throughout the state, And one thing they've done as well is put together some collaboratives. Tell us about the relationship between CMS and the Health Services Advisory Group.
Well, sure. So we have a number of organizations that are called quality improvement organizations, and HSAG is one of them. And I agree they do great work. And Mary Ellen Dalton is a friend of mine. She's the head of that company that's based in Arizona. They've done great work with Rick Potter, who's the doc who runs the program here in California. And we charge them and fund them to find needs in the healthcare community and then develop projects in concert with providers to improve those. And one of the areas we're going with them that I think is really important is if we think about primary care, which is clearly like a theme since the ACA for us in Medicare and in Medicaid as well, what we're worried about is there are large multi-specialty physician groups that are accountable care organizations that are delegated risk entities in managed care, and they're doing great, and they're meeting these targets. They've got their electronic health records. They've got their health team. But what about down in the Inland Empire or up by Ukiah, where you just have individual docs, and maybe they have one person that works with them doing administrative work? Maybe they're just on their own, or there's two doctors there. How are they going to embrace electronic technology and stratifying their patient population and so forth? It's going to be very difficult. But the people that go see those physicians need care just like everyone else. And so what we're developing is learning collaboratives using the QIOs and others to begin to help those practices to get better.
When those collaboratives were first coming together, it sounds like Contra Costa, for example, started off with a great attendance. Can you tell us from your perception or the ones you've attended, how did those come together? Were people attending right away? Have they really started to break it off into counties like Contra Costa has? It sounds like they've been pretty successful. Tell us a little bit more.
Well, it does sound like it is spilling over to a more local level, and I think it needs to, because when Dr. Berwick came to CMS, he brought all the senior leaders back for a retreat in Baltimore, and he talked about how coordinated care is the answer, that connecting providers one to another so that there's no gaps would be the most important thing we could do to improve healthcare. And it didn't register with me right away. It took a while. But when you look at the things that go wrong or badly in healthcare, it's because somebody didn't have a piece of information, somebody didn't know something. It's not usually because a person made an intentional mistake or actually made a mistake at all. So having the right information and sharing it is really valuable. And that's where getting the people in the room is important. Debbie Toth at the Rehab Services in NorCal, who put together that Contra Costa event, I remember she was nervous about, can we get the health plans and the hospitals to come to this thing? It's easy to get these small community providers, actually, but to get them all to work together is the hard part. And sometimes you have to change some existing relationships and get people in the room. But there's people there that believe in it, and I'm seeing it happen in some other places. Alameda County here, where I live, is doing some good work. So I think, you know, we're going to see a lot of progress. And what I really want to see is local elected leaders to begin to pay attention to this movement and to think about, you know, to what extent the health of the population in their town or their county is something that should be on their watch, because it should.
Well, it's neat to see that all these folks are coming together. Relationships are strengthening. With that strengthening, there's been obviously a bigger focus on data and outcomes as acute care organizations and the health systems in general want those positive outcomes from their providers. As they see these positive outcomes, there's a desire to partner more tightly with a narrow network of, you know, people who are producing great results. And, you know, the whole steering issue is always a hot topic. Can you tell us a little bit about CMS's perspective on narrowing networks and, you know, anti-steering versus what we can or can't do?
Yeah, I spoke at our partner training, annual national training in Orange County a few days ago, and this question came up there, as it often does. And it's absolutely the case that people in fee-for-service Medicare get to go to any qualified Medicare provider or outside a Medicare provider for a non-covered service that they'd like to. But at the same time, we know that if the hospital is the organization that we're looking to avoid the unnecessary readmission, to make sure that there's a successful outcome, that we reduce mortality for those conditions that we're looking at after 30 days, they need that network out in the community that's going to make that happen. And so it seems perfectly reasonable to us that a hospital planning the post-acute care for a patient in concert with their primary care physician can lay out a path that says, we recommend that you do this. For the following reasons. And people can go do something else if they'd like to, but there's no need to hide that there are other choices. The point is to present why we think you should go this way. It's kind of like I bring my car to the dealer. It'd probably be cheaper if I went to somebody else. But, you know, I had brakes put in the other day. I'm driving up to Tahoe today. I'm confident because I know that the Mazda dealer knows how to put brakes in a Mazda. And I'm going to be confident that when my hospital says, these people really do a good job in rehabilitation, and by the way, you can look them up on Medicare Compare and see that they get good results, then I'm going to be confident I'm going to go there. And the providers that aren't getting so much business and aren't doing a good job, hopefully will have the incentive to improve.
Thank you for that explanation, David. I think that's going to be really helpful to the audience. Another question I have on those lines, and Joe and I actually see it a lot in our main line of work outside of Pop Health Podcast on the home care side. I think assisted living communities, private duty agencies, out-of-pocket type providers to patients, are they under the same restrictions if they're not a CMS-funded entity?
You mean a restriction where they would be steering people to other entities?
Yeah, for example, let's say I'm a hospital and there's an assisted living close by that the patient's paying their own dollar with. Does CMS mandate that those hospitals have to give choice for those type of roles as well?
I don't believe that we could do that. I think that would be something that would be more of a local issue, just like a real estate agent in California needs to present the title companies that are available. They can't say you have to go to this title company. But that doesn't mean that they can't say, this company's convenient, we like to work with them, here's why you might want to work with them. That's okay.
Okay, great. I know we sometimes get different feedback from different locations, so appreciate that feedback. Let's jump over to the Medi-Medi population as Medi-Medi patients are shifting more and more into managed care. Can you tell us more about that transition and any challenges that you've seen?
Well, speaking specifically about CalMedi Connect, which is kind of the spearhead of our coordinated care effort, which is an activity that was specifically funded and created under the Affordable Care Act, no one thought this would be easy. So healthcare is as essential to our lives in modern-day America as eating or education or electricity. And when we change any of those things, it's not easy. If you've ever tried to go on a diet, you don't feel like yourself when you're not eating the things that you eat every day. And if you try to go to a new physician or a dentist, that's really hard to do. When I moved down to Baltimore, all the time I was there, I drove to Philadelphia to see my dentist in Philadelphia. So this program asks people to try working, in some cases, with different providers. So if you're a Medi-Medi beneficiary, you're down there in L.A., and you want to be part of the program that we have two vendors in that particular locality offering, that may mean for you working with a different doctor and a different care network. And some people don't want to do that, and we understand that, and that's why there is no mandatory enrollment on the Medicare side. People always have their freedom of choice. On the Medi-Cal side, the state has the ability under their waiver provisions and so forth to have people be in coordinated care plans, and that's something that they can do. But again, the freedom of choice remains in Medicare. So, yeah, we've seen more than half the people who had the opportunity to do this in LA say no thanks. And that's in large measure, we think, due to the fact that the providers that those individuals are working with weren't part of this program, and they'd like to keep their patients, and the patients would like to stay with the doctors they're working with, and that's fine. If we only have like 36 or 37% of the people in the program, there's a lot of people in Los Angeles County, so that's pretty good. I like to look at the people that we're serving, not the ones we're not serving. Now it's about, are we doing a really good job for those people? And when we get a few years into this, can we demonstrate that this thing works? Then in the future, maybe people will age into it and it'll catch on. We have got to find a way to get the care coordinated for these roughly a million dual-eligible people in California who are our most fragile, our most frail, and frankly, in many cases, challenging to work with populations because they have multiple chronic conditions.
So one of the questions I have with Medi-Cal, sometimes there's people out there, and I think, Joe, you actually knew this one. You were talking about fully funding Medi-Cal, Joe?
Yes. One of the things that we've heard a lot in Southern California are campaigns in the local news pushing to fully fund Medi-Cal. David, we wanted to get your thoughts on those initiatives.
Well, from our perspective, we require that the states have rates that they pay to providers and health plans that are sufficient that the population can get access to services. And we watch for that. We're looking at that all the time. And we have providers and associations talking to us all the time about that challenge. At the same time, we appreciate that states are stretched financially. Medicaid has grown exponentially in a lot of states. Education has become more expensive. There are a lot of challenges facing state governments. So do states, as a rule, pay the same rates as private payers or Medicare pays to physicians or to hospitals? Well, it varies. But in some cases, it's somewhat less. But is it less enough that people can't get the service? That's when we have a problem. And we're not really seeing that, and we look for that. So I'm sure there are providers that would like Medi-Cal to pay better. And I'm sure if the governor and the legislature could afford it, they would pay better, but they have many other things that they have to worry about funding. But we're watching that. Certainly it's a concern. And I think that the answer lies in taking it back to this issue of the coordinated of care. So if we can better coordinate care through networks and perhaps health plans that are looking at a patient in a more holistic patient-centered way, then we can get a program that maybe looks a little bit more like the Access program in Arizona, where they're in the top 5 or 10% of Medicaid payment rates because they're working through health plans that manage the care effectively so that they don't have as many visits and they can pay the providers better for those visits and people have more access or more variety of providers to choose from as a result. But here in California, biggest state, I think it's the second largest Medicaid program in the country, so it's not an easy thing to change.
Thanks, David. I'm glad that you mentioned Arizona's program through Access, their state Medicaid program. They have a program called Altex, which some of our audience members might be aware of, in which eligible nursing home eligible seniors have a choice where they can choose either nursing homes, assisted livings, or receiving non-medical attendant-level care at home through contracted providers. We wanted to get your thoughts on that program and if you feel it's successful, as well as if something similar can be done in other states or already is being done.
I think that this place where we have folks that meet a level of need, that they're the kind of folks that would qualify for coverage in a nursing home under Medicaid, is a place where lots of states are trying lots of things with varying levels of success. One of the challenges of the CalMediConnect is they're rolling in the long-term care part of services under a managed care umbrella. There's not a lot of experience doing that. But clearly, one of the keys to working with that population is reducing the level of folks that go into those places and finding ways to make the care at home work. And that, to me, a big piece of that is, can you engage families and caregivers? Because you just can't have somebody sitting at everyone's house 24 hours a day. That would end up being more expensive than having the people in institutions. But we know that people prefer to be at home. We've reflagged our agency on aging, and we call it the Agency of Community Living, because we want people to live in their communities with their friends and their families and the church they go to and institutions, because that's a full life for people. That's the way they want to, where they want to be, and we want to put them there. Arizona is a very astute state government. They've done great things in their Medi-Cal program. I think they're doing really good things keeping people at home in Arizona with their Altex program, and they're doing great things with health data exchange, where they're rolling even behavioral health into a statewide data exchange. So there's a lot of good things going there. It's a great state to keep an eye on.
Looks like I'll have to learn more about Arizona. I know, Joe, you're out there from time to time. So,
correct.
All right, so the future of Medicare. You know, we all see it on our pay stubs. You know, it's all in the news, you know, the future of Medicare, future of Social Security. Can you tell us your thoughts, David, on the future of Medicare and let's say 10, 20, 30 years? Do you think it'll be much different? Do you have any thoughts there?
Well, one thing that won't be different is the United States government is not going to renege on its commitment to seniors and people with disabilities in terms of providing health care. But the way we do it and the way that we fund it is likely to change, just like it's been changing since 1965. And one of the ways it's changing is we're moving away from paying a fixed price for an unlimited number of services and rather looking at the value of the services that we provide and look that they get the results and the outcomes that people want. And we're having some success with that, and we've seen the growth rate in Medicare costs slow down as a result of that. So we're making progress in that area. I don't think people need to worry. But if you look at it today, an individual You mentioned that you pay into your taxes for Medicare Part A. So for most people, they've invested 2% of what they made in their entire lifetime in that Medicare Part A premium. But the average Medicare beneficiary will bring back many times that. I think it's 10 or 20% of what they made in their lifetime in terms of Part A costs. So we've got a program where there's a lot of funding required that wasn't put in there by the people that are, you know, benefiting from the program now. Government's committed to those people. We need to find a better way to run the program more efficiently so that people can have, you know, the meaningful community-based lives that they want to have, free of disease that can be avoided, and make that affordable at the same time. And that's not something that's going to happen with one single stroke of health reform or law. It's going to happen a little bit of time over a long period of time, and that's the direction that we're going.
Well, another direction it seems that we're going is, as you mentioned earlier, healthcare at home. And just keeping people in their home, again, not around-the-clock care, but engaging patients, engaging families to, you know, self-care and be committed and be compliant. What are some common trends you see at a CMS level with compliance? And do you see more social programs perhaps benefiting folks at remaining at home? For example, there's a group in Southern California called Partners in Care that's a community-based organization that works with many hospitals doing kind of some social-type visits in the home and engaging patients, coaching patients. Do you feel that's being effective? Do you see more of that in the future?
I think there's a lot of variations on that that are great. Here in the city of Alameda, we have a grant from the state where our paramedics, who would be sitting around waiting for a call, go out and visit people that they know are frequent flyers of the emergency room or are frail and so forth, just to see how they're doing and check on their meds and so forth. I think that that's really where the answer is, and it again takes you back to what I saw as that community focus. What are we doing to take care of the people that are here in our community? One of the things that we don't do at CMS is we don't really talk about patient compliance. We don't really think about it that way. We think of it as engagement. So how can we get the person interested in their care? How can we get them excited about their care? How can we get their family interested in their care? How can we get people to see care as something that's going to make life better rather than some chore that has to be done? In a lot of ways, it's not that different than what you're doing with students in a school. You want them to be excited about learning. You want to be engaged in it. You want them to look forward to coming to school. And the same thing has to be true in the healthcare space. We need to turn patients on, if you will, to paying attention to their meds and to doing screening procedures or whatever it might be, because there's a payoff for that. And what happens is the natural payoff of health doesn't seem to be enough to get people to do some of these things. And so we have to find better ways to do that. And these programs that put people in the home face to face with caregivers and patients, I think, is a great place to start.
So do you see the future of Medicare's provider pool perhaps adding more of these care transitions, care coaching type groups?
Well, what we're seeing is, you know, the secretary has a goal for us to move half of our Medicare fee-for-service reimbursements into alternative payment models over the next few years. And what we're seeing in some of our accountable care organizations and our pioneer accountable care organizations is they've already moved ahead on this kind of work where they've engaged an entire care team ranging from lay people that just call at-risk patients on the phone to maintain a dialogue and see how they're doing, to physicians making home visits and all sorts of sort of non-traditional things that wouldn't be reimbursed by fee-for-service Medicare. But these organizations are finding that by making an investment in those kinds of activities, they may avoid one or two hospitalizations that could cost $10,000 or $20,000 apiece, and it turns out to be a good investment. They're in a better position to make that investment than we are as fee-for-service Medicare. We can't get down on the ground and run the local health system.
The future of fee-for-service Medicare 5-10 years from now, will it still exist? Where will it exist? Where will the biggest changes be there?
When I talk about this to people, I always hearken to the image of when they invented light beer and they had the commercial saying that it was it tasted great and it was less filling. So, you know, 30% of our Medicare beneficiaries are in Medicare Advantage plans. Those plans get good health results for those people. They use resources more efficiently than fee-for-service Medicare does. But only 30% of our beneficiaries want to be in those plans. And another 70%, and in some cases because it's where they're located, 70% of people choose to be in fee-for-service Medicare because they like that freedom of choice. But one of the things that we know from studying it is that freedom of choice is like that suit in your closet that you haven't worn a couple of years. You like having it because you might want to wear it someday, but the reality is you're never going to wear it. And most people, 95% of the time, they're going to the hospital that's in their community and they're going to that same physician. So what we're trying to do in these alternative payment models is how can we bring to bear the incentives that exist in capitated environments in terms of getting outcomes and using resources more effectively and making patients stick to your practice more? How can we get fee-for-service providers to do that? That's what we're doing in accountable care and bundled payments and programs like that.
So we've talked a lot about managed care, and you just used the term capitated. There's a group out there called CAPG that I just recently learned about. Does CMS work with them? Are you guys involved with CAPG? Is there a relationship there?
Absolutely. I have a great relationship with Don Crane at CAPG and Laura Hawkins and all the folks there. CAPG, for those that are listening, you probably know, is the trade association of our medical groups here in California. And we have a number of large, very sophisticated groups that take full risk for health plans or near full risk. And so they're almost like running their own health plan, almost like a staff model HMO. And they get really good results and they bring really good science to it. And they're a large part of the group that were our first batch of pioneer ACOs, where they use some of their patient management and coordination techniques on the fee-for-service patients that they see. So I think those medical groups are a great model because what we see there is sort of physicians running the show. And I think that, you know, physicians are uniquely qualified to really understand what taking care of people is all about. And when we see ones that want to really engage the business side and the medical side, we see really great results in some of those groups like, you know, Health Partners or Heritage or Monarch down in Southern California.
Great, David. Well, we're about out of time here on our podcast today. If there's one takeaway that the audience can have with your role at CMS and the future of CMS, maybe in 30 seconds to a minute or so, what would you say is the biggest takeaway? How can we work best with CMS in the years ahead?
Well, I think we are really making an effort to be open and share with people what we're doing and have more things on the internet, but we don't hear from folks enough. Not enough people are commenting when we put rules out there to comment. When we put them out there, you're going to read in the preamble the comment that you made because we read every one of them and we think about them. And we're there on the telephone. We can be called. We have offices in 10 cities. We want to know, what are we doing wrong? What could we do better? And so one of the things that would be really great is if the provider community would be a little bit more confident and comfortable in reaching out to us and telling us how we can do a better job, because you're the ones that are taking care of the people. We're not. We're here to enable you. We're supposed to be serving you.
So I think the key takeaway there from David is feedback. Giving CMS feedback, and typically we do the word of the day in the middle of our podcast, but we're actually going to do it at the end today, and that word of the day is feedback. For the audience members listening, please email Gavin or info@pophealthpodcast.com with the word feedback as the word of the day and your t-shirt size, and you'll be entered into a raffle for a free Pop Health Podcast t-shirt. We're about to go ahead and wrap up the podcast. Joe Zimmer has been my co-host today. Joe, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much, Gavin. And thank you, David, for taking your time today.
It was a pleasure.